Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, the first World Humanitarian Day remembers all those who've lost their lives bringing aid to people in places of crisis or conflict. Just Add Water is the name of a new campaign by one Catholic development agency highlighting the effects that climate change is already having in the poorest countries of the world. And Loch Derg, one of the oldest pilgrimage sites in Western Europe, sees a big increase in pilgrims over the summer months. United Nations and aid organisations around the world observed the first World Humanitarian Day on August the 19th, recalling all those who have lost their lives while bringing assistance to people in situations of crisis or conflict. Established by the General Assembly of the United Nations in December 2008, the observance is aimed at increasing public understanding about the tireless work of those who put their lives at risk to bring humanitarian aid to others. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon paid tribute to all those who have been killed or injured while carrying out such crucial activities in increasingly difficult and dangerous situations. The UN says 260 humanitarian aid workers were killed, abducted or harmed in attacks in 2008. In fact, the statistics show that the fatality rate for international aid workers last year exceeded that of UN peacekeeping troops.
The environments they're working in are getting more dangerous, and I think it's important to know that if something happens to one of us, that isn't taken for granted.
Alistair Dutton is Humanitarian Director for Caritas Internationalis, the global confederation of Catholic aid and development agencies. Marking this first World Humanitarian Day, Caritas called on governments worldwide to allow aid agencies access to the most vulnerable communities, saying its ability to support people in conflicts has been severely restricted by the actions of governments over the last 18 months in countries such as Zimbabwe, Gaza, Sri Lanka or Sudan. Alistair talked to my colleague Lydia O'Kane about the importance of this annual observance and the increasing dangers that aid workers face in countries around the world.
Well, as you say, it's the first World Humanitarian Day. And really its purpose is twofold. It's to commemorate those who have given their lives in the course of trying to hand out humanitarian assistance to those who need it. And secondly, it's to increase people's understanding of what humanitarian assistance is and what that means worldwide. It's on the 19th of August because in 2003, on that day, the United Nations office was bombed in Baghdad, and there were 22 people killed in that one incident alone. So we're commemorating it on the anniversary of that day, but very much bearing in mind all those who've given their lives.
Alistair, it is a sad fact. I was just looking at a report, and attacks against aid workers have increased. And even last year, in 2008, 260 aid workers were victims of violent attacks. And we're looking at some also in different countries, in Sudan, Darfur area, Afghanistan and Somalia. People who are trying to help are being targeted.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as you say, the number in 2008 was 260, and that's up from 69 in 1998, so only 10 years earlier. We are seeing some of the theatres we're working in getting increasingly dangerous for aid workers, and that's a reality we have to manage as we're trying to continue to get the help to those who need it. And unfortunately, it means that on occasions we lose close friends and colleagues in the course of their work.
I mean, is there a danger in some instances that, aid organisations just can't put their aid workers at risk, that they have to pull them out?
It varies considerably. It varies very much from place to place and also with organisations. Most of the humanitarian organisations, the non-governmental organisations, the names one would normally associate with humanitarianism. So most of the members of the Caritas, most of the northern members of the Caritas Confederation, the likes of Oxfam, Save the Children, World Vision, etc. Security management is something we take very seriously, and an assessment of what the risks people would face is very much a part of the decision as to whether we would send people. And there are areas of Iraq or Afghanistan, bits of Darfur, that we wouldn't ask people to work in at the moment. I think one of the reason I'm kind of hedging a bit when I talk about Caritas is that when we look at our national members, so the church in the countries we're talking about, the staff, the priests, sisters and laity who work for these national Caritases, it's not a new situation for them. This is their home. They come from these areas. Their families still live in these areas and they've always worked in these areas. So to say we wouldn't work in those settings would not recognise the great work that goes on by those people who come from those areas. And so one of the things we always say is before the international members arrive, the local church, the local Caritas is already working. And part of the reason I think, well, certainly when I look at some of the deaths we've had in the last year, I think our staff are much less willing to leave the people behind because they would see themselves as the pastors of those people themselves. In Sri Lanka earlier this year, very unfortunately, we had a driver who was killed in the no-fire zone. Raj was a man of 26 who came from Jaffna and was killed in the no-fire zone. And he was with the priests and the sisters who, alongside the people who were caught in that area. And very much the line that Caritas, the priests and the sisters and all the staff took was that they could not leave their own people behind. And so while other aid agencies were not working in the non-fire zone, with the exception of Caritas and the Red Cross, they were the only two who did remain. And for the church, that was very much because they said, we are the local church, we can't leave the local people.
Alistair, how important do you think it is to have days like this, a day like this, especially when you're honouring people that are killed or injured on the front lines of conflict?
I do think it's incredibly important. I think it's very important for the friends and families of those who have been killed to know that we don't take for granted the lives of their loved ones that were lost in the course of the work we do and them fulfilling what they saw as their duty in that work. I think it's also very important to all of our staff, to all humanitarian workers across the globe, because, as we've already said, the environments they're working in are getting more dangerous. And I think it's important to know that if something happens to one of us, that isn't taken for granted. You know, that the sacrifice we make is recognized. I don't want to overplay that. I'm not trying to, you know, say, aren't we wonderful, or that there's some kind of heroism or almost bloodthirsty search for martyrdom going on here. But I think it is dangerous. And it would be wrong for those who go out there every day if we didn't mark the very sad occasions when something bad happens. I think we do have to, on World Humanitarian Day, though, remember all those who lose their lives. And first and foremost, that is the people themselves who are caught up in the conflicts or the various different humanitarian disasters. In number, they far outweigh the aid workers who are killed. And also, it is they and their communities who are blighted by the emergencies in the first place. So I think it is important to remember our own staff, those who have died and those who go out into these areas. But I think we need to bear in mind everybody caught up in emergencies rather than just the aid workers themselves.
My thanks there to Alistair Dutton, Humanitarian Director for Caritas Internationalis, talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. Meanwhile, the International Development Agency Progressio has recently launched a new campaign focusing on the crucial issue of water for communities in some of the poorest regions of the world. Formerly called the Catholic Institute for International Relations, the London-based Progressio is working with other faith-based organisations to keep the problems of climate change at the top of the agenda of world leaders. The new campaign, entitled Just Add Water, highlights the plight of many poor farmers and their families who've already been badly affected by climate change and the inability to access water to grow their own crops. Media officer Joe Barrett tells my colleague Eamon McCarthy more about the background to this campaign.
Actually, 1 in 6 of the world's population don't have access to safe water. And amongst the hardest hit of those are some of the 1.4 billion small-scale farmers around the world. And climate change is actually just going to make that a whole lot worse. So the Just Add Water campaign is designed to pressure world leaders who are meeting at a massive climate change summit in Copenhagen this December not to forget water when they come to make their massive decisions that will affect the way the world tackles climate change over the coming years. And that is why we're trying to urge people to sign up to the campaign.
What does the campaign actually involve? Is it simply just a question of people adding their signatures to a petition, or is there anything else that Progressio is asking people to do?
Well, the campaign, and in fact hundreds of leaflets and postcards are already coming back into the offices here in Progressio in London, is essentially trying to get people involved by writing to their MP if they live in the UK, their Member of Parliament. But if you don't live in the UK, there's still a lot of other things that you can do. You can log onto our website, you can join a local group where you live ahead of Copenhagen, and you can pray. I mean, we really are trying to pray for world leaders at this time to make sure that they take the right decisions when they meet at this big summit.
Now, of course, in the climate change debate, we hear an awful lot about CO2 emissions. We hear about major world industries being asked to think again about becoming more green. We hear about the melting of the polar caps in the north and the south. But we very rarely hear about the issue of water itself. And yet some scientists have been warning that in the next millennium, in the next 100 years indeed, water instead of oil will become the world's most expensive and rarest commodity. Is this what you're trying to underline as well through this campaign?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I think people, some of the world's poorest people who Progressio works with, are telling us that water is a massive issue for them. And like you say, world leaders do get a bit caught up with emissions. You know, emissions are constantly the thing that we hear about in terms of climate change negotiations. Recently, I went out to Ecuador and met a lady there called Esperanza. And she has a small little farm, and she's a mother of 3 teenage sons. And she took me out and to show me her farm, and she said, look, you know, climate change is already happening for me. She said, it doesn't rain when it used to. The ground is really dry. I plant my potatoes and they don't grow. And these are the type of people that Progressio is really trying to include in the debate. We want world leaders to remember, that you know, people like Esperanza exist and they have a very valid voice. And instead of being able to grow her own potatoes, Esperanza is having to go to the local shops and actually buy food for her sons. And that's why we need to act now, because it's some of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people who are most at risk. In fact, many of our communities, the communities that we work with in countries around the world, are reporting similar concerns. In Malawi, our country director there, a guy called Lloyd, also said the same thing. He said, you know, climate's so different to what it used to be. You know, it rains when it didn't used to rain. It's much drier than it used to be. And I think the unpredictability of the weather, particularly, is what's causing people to be concerned. Because these small-scale farmers in countries like Malawi rely on the weather. You know, they rely on being able to know when to put their potatoes in. And if they can't follow the historic pattern that they've used and that their ancestors have used, then suddenly they're left without any resources, without any food, feed their children. And that's the kind of thing that is really, you know, happening now. I mean, and these are the people, some of the poorest people in the world, and that's really why we have to keep them at the forefront of our minds.
In the recent G8 or enlarged G8 summit that took place here in Italy, there seemed to be a lot of disaccord regarding the targets that have been set ahead of Copenhagen, not only to do with the reduction of emissions, but also with world leaders' commitment to doing something actively about climate change when they meet in Copenhagen to discuss a replacement to the Kyoto Protocol. What is progress you're calling on world leaders to do? What steps do you think need to be put in place?
Well, Progressio is part of a big UK coalition called the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition. And together we are working to get a few key asks in this major climate change document. One of which is that global temperatures must be stopped from rising. Global temperatures currently are likely to increase by about 4 degrees by 2100, and that really must be brought down. We're also asking developed countries, rich nations, to take the bulk of the responsibility. I mean, we cause a lot of this greenhouse gas that's floating around in the atmosphere, so we need to take steps to reduce our own emissions. At the same time, we're also asking developing countries to take their bulk of the responsibility. Economies like China and India, which are growing really, really quickly, also need to sit up and say, you know what, yeah, we're going to take steps as well to reduce our emissions. So I think there's a broad package of action that needs to happen. But we do have to remember in all of this that it's the world's poor and the world's most vulnerable who are likely to suffer. And rich nations really have to take the lead on showing, you know, the rest of the world that there is an example to be made. I mean, Pope Benedict just reminded us a few weeks ago in his latest encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, that as Catholics particularly, we have a grave duty to protect the earth for future generations. I mean, we are using the earth's resources in an unsustainable manner, and we really must inhabit the planet and continue to cultivate it, but also protect it for future generations and for our children. And I think that that's not just, obviously, a Catholic message. It's very much a Christian message. And we must all act together, really, with a common voice, I think, to show that we're ready to do this and to also urge international leaders, the people who are taking the decisions, to make these difficult choices. And yes, it will be hard. I mean, we will have to change our lifestyles and we might have to fly less and use our cars less. But really, there's no alternative, because if people are already suffering the effects of climate change, as they are, then the time to act is now. We can't get to a situation where we have a 4 degree rise in global temperatures. That will spell utter disaster. And there's a positive note here. I think we have a real opportunity to work together, and that's what Progressio is trying to do with this campaign.
Thanks there to Joe Barrett, Media Officer for the International Development Agency Progressio, talking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. Making a pilgrimage has been part of the Christian way of life for many centuries, and one of the oldest pilgrimage sites in Western Europe has seen a large increase in numbers of visitors recently. It's the ancient sanctuary of St. Patrick, located at Lough Derg in County Donegal, on the border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. Over the summer months, this remote lake island, also known as St. Patrick's Purgatory, offers a place of peace and personal reconciliation, where pilgrims worship, fast and keep vigil, walking barefoot around the 9 stations on the island. Bishop Joseph Duffy of Clocher, in whose diocese Lough Derg lies, speaks with Monsignor Liam McDade about the history of this unusual place of pilgrimage.
Well, the history of Lough Derg goes back a long, long way, and if you want to get the roots of it, you'd really have to go to the Old Testament, where there's a tradition there already of pilgrimage, of people going to a holy place. Right back in the book of Genesis, Jacob went to a place called Bethel, because God had appeared there. And then the Jews, of course, went annually to Jerusalem, as we know, to the temple. The Christians, early Christians, took up that same practice of going to Jerusalem when the persecutions ended in the 4th century. And then later on, we had pilgrims going to Rome very frequently, to the holy places where the tombs of the apostles Peter and Paul were. And so this practice of pilgrimage was very much part of the Christian life from the very early stages, and developed, of course, throughout the Middle Ages in a big way. Not only Rome and Jerusalem, but every country developed its own place of pilgrimage. And in Ireland, Lough Derg became this, if you like, national place of pilgrimage, whereas in Spain it was Compostela, and in France it was Tours, and Canterbury in England, and so on. Ireland had Lough Derg. It was so important that it was the only place marked on a map of 1492, to give you an idea just of how important Lough Derg was in the history of our country. So Lough Derg was a significant, has a significant part in Irish church history, Irish Christian history from the very beginning.
Bishop, at the present time, Lough Derg is a peaceful place of pilgrimage, but in the past it did experience some turbulent times. Would you like to say a little bit about that?
Certainly. Lough Derg has a very stormy history, I suppose maybe consistent with the kind of weather conditions that you get there, and the fact that it's in a very rugged and barren part of the country. History reflects that whole thing. We're told that monks came there as early as the 6th century and to get away off the beaten track, to get away from, you know, normal people's doings and business and so on, and set up a monastery in a place called Saints Island, of which Station Island was an adjunct, if you like, where the pilgrimage takes place today. So that there was a monastery there, and that's important for the history, because later on, when times got bad, it was the monastery that was attacked. And if you like, the monastery came a cropper in the 17th century when the persecutions began. But even before that, the purgatory itself was closed down by Pope in 1497 because of abuses attached to it by presumably through the monastery, abuses of simony, you know, the taking money for overcharging pilgrims, basically overcharging pilgrims. That was the first, if you like, negative part of Lough Derg history. Then, of course, there was the whole vandalism of the Puritan period, the total destruction of the monuments and the icons, and everything about the island was ruthlessly destroyed. That happened in 1632, and that was followed then by a period of, if you like, penalisation, where pilgrims were penalised. They were breaking the law, literally, by going to Lough Derg, and then they were exploited by the landlord and by the boatmen and so on. And that business went on right through the 17th and 18th century. And eventually then, when people got more freedom and there was emancipation, things got much better, and the Diocese of Clogher took over the pilgrimage in 1780. But later on, the whole process of, if you like, the legal restrictions on the place continued right through the 19th century, when it came to buildings and so on the island. These were contested by the landlord, who objected to the diocese building on or slightly off the surface of the island. So it was only in the 20th century that, if you like, all this died down, and the pilgrimage got the full freedom to do its business.
Looking at the present day situation again, what is offered by the Lough Derg pilgrimage?
Lough Derg today reflects the whole biblical image of desert. In other words, of going into a quiet place, something like what John the Baptist did in the time of our Lord, where people followed John into the wilderness, into a place where they could be away from normal living, and where they could more or less, I suppose, make their peace with life and with the Lord and so on. That's a consistent theme that runs through Lough Derg and that ties it securely into Christian living and into the Bible in particular. Then there's the other business of purgatory. People often wonder, You know, the place being called purgatory, is that not an outdated concept? Which, of course, it is. People don't talk nowadays about, they don't use the word purgatory. But when you think about it, what purgatory is, we would use the word reconciliation today. We would use the word, you know, trying to restore harmony with the world and with oneself, and ultimately with the Creator. So that this task of reconciliation, that's absolutely central to Lough Derg. And if I may say so, these days, and rightly, there's an attention given to the community dimension of this, without ignoring the individual reconciliation, that there is the idea that it's the community that needs reconciliation. I suppose this came home to us all very, very forcibly in the recent past in Northern Ireland with the conflict there. And remembering that Lough Derg is situated right on the border between Donegal and Fermanagh, it's ideally placed and has in fact been a place where people have made their peace and done so consistently over the last 30 or so years.
Bishop, personally and spiritually, what is offered by the Lough Derg experience? And maybe you'd like to say a word or two about why Lough Derg has such an appeal for people of all ages.
Well, I've already touched on that, I think, by saying that, you know, it's so central to the need that we all have as human beings, you know, in our fragmented condition, to make, you know, to look for harmony in our lives, to look for peace in those areas where there's trouble, where there's difficulty, where there's conflict, and to find a place where this process can be given attention. And by getting away from it all, even getting away from mobile phones and from getting away from even the noise of traffic and so on, and getting into a peaceful environment, and also having the support of other people exactly in the same condition as ourselves, all doing the same thing, all following a program which is intensive, but it's very tangible and very definitive. And that's one of the things people like about Lough Derg. They know exactly what they have to do, what's expected of them. The simple rule about fasting, about the keeping awake, the vigil, which, of course, is so difficult. We're all exactly the same in Lough Derg. And that, I think, gives people a great sense of solidarity and a great sense of understanding and even of good humour and so on, people, and helping each other. And even people who can depreciate the efforts that possibly people with not the same strength or health that other people have, the efforts they make, all of that does help enormously to give people the kind of reassurance, you know, that God is good and that there is something worthwhile here. And of course, then there's an enormous sense of satisfaction when it's over. And it's not just relief. It's not just the kind of relief that one senses when you get out of prison or something like that. There's that element to it. But there's also, I think, this sense that that this place has been a kind of a tonic for people. That somebody has used the word detox. You know, I mean, I think we all know what that means. But it does. Physically and mentally and spiritually. And psychologically, every way you can think of, holistically, I suppose, there is this sense of achievement, a sense of having done something worthwhile, a great sense of uplift and of almost a purgation of oneself. You know, you've purged yourself. It may be just your physical appetites or something like that, but it does certainly clear one's head in a big way.
You were listening there to Bishop Joseph Duffy of the Irish Diocese of Clocher, in whose diocese the pilgrimage site of Lough Derg lies. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.